From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Luis Antonio Perez, sitting in for Maria Hinojosa. This week, we look into a big story in my hometown of Chicago, a plan to close more than 50 schools in the third largest school system in the nation.
And I feel like they're saying, you just need to face the music and it's going to happen. It's like, no, we think it's going to stay open, so listen to us.
How will changing the school map shake up communities all over the city? Next.
I was surprised, actually, by Disney's move.
Latinos give Mickey Mouse's parent company an earful.
I think the Latino community did a wonderful job of lifting up this issue and leveraging social media tools in order to amplify it.
News and noise about Disney and Dia de los Muertos. And the tough ladies of Mexican roller derby.
Psycho Chola, número 13, Tijuana.
Ana with balls, 29 de aquí de Tijuana.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Luis Antonio Perez. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Luis Antonio Perez, sitting in for Maria Hinojosa. This week, we're in Chicago, my hometown, where I host the radio show The Vocalo Overdrive. Like many cities, Chicago is in a financial crisis. So in March, city officials announced that they would close 54 public elementary schools they say are underutilized. Since then, parents, teachers, and activists have protested across the city to try and keep schools open. Latino USA teamed up with students at the Medill School of Journalism here in Chicago to report on the issue. In our first story, we go to Elizabeth Peabody Elementary School on the city's west side, where 95% of the students are low income and 76% are Latino. Paige Sutherland and Tanya Basu report. First, Tanya.
You'd never guess from walking down the halls of Peabody that this school is considered by the Chicago public school system to be underutilized. The halls are buzzing with activity, with kids hopping down the stairs and teachers attempting to keep order.
Oh, no. You either put your trousers around your waist or you're going to go to the office and call your parents.
255 students are enrolled at Peabody. CPS says the building has room for twice that many students.
If the Chicago Board of Education votes to close the school next week, students will be reassigned in the fall to James Otis Elementary, less than a mile south. Zaria Brim is a 7th grade honor student at Peabody.
We still have hope for the school to stay open. And I feel like they're saying, you just need to face the music and it's going to happen. It's like, no, we think it's going to stay open. So listen to us.
Zaria knows her way around the hallways.
It's like home away from home is familiar. I know everybody around and I feel comfortable around them.
Luis Quiñones, better known as Mr. Q, is like a second father to most of the students. He has worked as a security guard for the past 17 years at Peabody. He is the first person the children see when they walk in.
I treated a lot of the kids like they were my own. And they respected me like that. And they respected the fact that I was trying to help them out in their lives as well as their homework.
Mr. Q, I love Mr. Q. He's just so nice. And I feel sad to see how it turns out for him.
The school board says it will save $438 million over the next 10 years. Officials promise that students affected by school closures will be transferred to schools that are equal or better performing. The most powerful opponent to the closings is the Chicago Teachers Union. The union called the closures racist and classist because most students affected are low-income African-American and Latino. Jackson Potter is a staff coordinator at the Chicago Teachers Union.
You know, it begs the question, would they have done this to well-established white families that, you know, are middle class? The answer is absolutely not.
Chicago Public Schools Chief Barbara Bird Bennett called the claims of racism an insult. She said most Chicago public school students are black or Hispanic, so naturally, the closings will affect children of color. And CPS is offering services to ease the transition, though they declined to comment. At Peabody, students have already begun participating in once-a-week group counseling sessions.
25 rambunctious sixth graders are barely paying attention as counselor Will Martinez tries to prepare them for the move. He guides them through relaxation exercises with stress balls and practicing breathing.
So as you can imagine, coming in, there's a lot of feelings involved on all sides, and having 30 minutes to talk about something that is this complicated is not exactly ideal, but do the best that you can in the 30 minutes you have.
Zaria is starting to understand why her counselor is here, but she's still skeptical.
I feel like she's here because she's trying to do her job, but she's also sort of trying to make a connection towards us.
Do you feel any more prepared for the transition?
No. Not really. We just talk about our feelings.
Psychologists say it's natural for middle schoolers to be anxious about making new friends and fitting in. And for troubled students, if the transition is difficult, it could change the course of their lives. For Latino USA, I'm Paige Sutherland.
And I'm Tanya Basu.
Anyone can tell you that Chicago is a city of neighborhoods, but I can tell you that Chicago is also a city of blocks. The obstacles can change dramatically from one street to the next. In Chicago's North Lawndale neighborhood, parents and students are concerned about their safety if they have to switch schools. Medill reporters Anunt Baliga and Lisa Carter have more.
It's 7 a.m., and students are arriving at Nathaniel Pope Elementary School on Chicago's southwest side.
Good morning, how you doing?
See you later, Daddy!
At 7:40 a.m. sharp, it's time to line up.
I want my fourth graders, I'm leaving.
The students walk into school through metal detectors and pick up their breakfasts before heading to class.
Let's go, let's go. Don't stop. Get back, keep going. Don't stop.
And at 8 a.m.,
school begins.
If Pope shuts its doors, students here will go to Johnson School of Excellence. It's only a half a mile away, but for Pope students, it means crossing Ogden Avenue, which is a major highway, and traversing deep-set ganglines belonging to the traveling Vice Lords and the New Breed gangs. Pope 8th grader Juan Soto is graduating and will be going to high school next year. But he is concerned about his 9-year-old sister, Yasleen.
When no one's home, she might have to walk by herself over there. She's going to be scared for her safety.
Soto says he's had to negotiate gang sentinels before.
They actually just ask where you are. They sometimes rough you up, most like that. Or most times they just ask you where and just let you go. But you never really know most times, so it's kind of frightening.
Chicago Police Department's Sergeant Ramon Ferrer, who is assigned to the schools, says concerns about gang violence are understandable, but overblown.
The likelihood of cross-gang crossfire between gangs can't be totally, absolutely negated, but the practicality is nothing like that has ever happened that affected the students.
Mayor Rahm Emanuel and Chicago Public Schools Chief Barbara Bird Bennett have assured parents of their commitment to safety. Their plan involves expanding the Safe Passage program, which has unarmed civilian guards in neon green vests standing watch on the streets around school before and after class. Pope's security guard Malcolm Slaughter is skeptical of the mayor's efforts.
It's just, if you see something, you just call the police. And you, of course, you know how long it takes the police to get somewhere. I don't think it's going to really help the kids.
Kevin Cunningham is an 8th grade science teacher at Pope. He says there's a long-standing animosity between students from Pope and Johnson.
They don't even go across the park to play basketball, something that they want to do. So what makes you think they're going to go across the park to go to another school?
He says the prospect of switching schools has his students worried.
There's no love there. And you can see the concern on their faces when we bring it up. Some of them, frankly, don't know what they're going to do.
The school board will make its decision at the end of the month. If Pope Elementary is one of the schools to be closed, district officials say they will station additional security at Johnson and other welcoming schools in order to minimize potential problems. For Latino USA, I'm Anand Baliga.
And I'm Lisa Carter.
These stories were reported and produced by journalism students in the audio reporting class at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, taught by Cecilia Weissman. Can corporations trademark heritage? For many, that's exactly what Disney tried to do on May 1st when it applied to trademark El Día de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, for merchandise tied to a new Pixar movie inspired by the Mexican holiday. For this week's News or Noise, where we take a look at media matters that may involve misunderstanding or misinformation, we talk about El Día de los Trademarks. Less than a day after the move was reported on an industry website, Latinos made their voices heard. Among the loudest critics was editorial cartoonist and creator of La Cucaracha, a daily comic strip, Lalo Alcaraz.
You know, a lot of artists create Dia de los Muertos items, t-shirts, objects. And who's to say that, you know, the Disney Corporation wouldn't come saying, well, we own the trademark for this phrase, so you can't use it. That is just one aspect of the problem, besides cultural appropriation.
On May 7th, less than a week after the trademark application was filed, and hours after a Change.org petition garnered 20,000 signatures, Disney released a statement announcing that it was withdrawing its application because the title of the film had changed. But would trademarking El Día de los Muertos mean legally owning a part of Latino culture? Marshall Liefer is a copyright law expert and professor at Indiana University's Maurer School of Law.
Disney could own the Day of the Dead only in referring to its own film or its own special kinds of merchandising objects. It couldn't have a general ownership of Day of the Dead if they enforced these trademark rights too vigorously under the Day of the Dead, for instance. They would undermine their own market. They would shoot themselves in the foot, so to speak.
Whether or not Disney bowed to the pressure created online, the fast mobilizing around the issue among Latinos was notable. Katie Esquivel is a digital strategist and vice president for Fenton. She joins us from the NPR studios in New York City to talk about the reaction from the Latino online community. Katie, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you so much for having me.
Walk us through your take on what happened in the digital world when news of this trademark application went viral.
So what happened was the Latino community, who is already over-indexing on these platforms and truly has over the course of the last few years, learned how to leverage them in order to mobilize and express itself, used that knowledge to be able to respond and force to this move by Disney, which didn't work for the community.
Were you surprised at the reaction of the Latino community online?
I was not. I was surprised, actually, by Disney's move. Companies are looking at us and they're trying to figure out how to engage us, how to interact with us, how to woo us. And so, you know, I've been impressed with a lot of positive things Disney has done. And so what I was really surprised at was Disney taking this step, which truly was a cultural faux pas, and which alienated a lot of the constituency that it was trying to engage through other mechanisms.
Is the Latino market also telling companies like Disney how they should be marketed too?
Yeah, I think that you hit the nail on the head. There needs to be an authentic conversation between companies and the communities that they're trying to engage. And, you know, there needs to be sensitivity all across the board. But in this particular instance, they were not considering their audience.
So let me ask you, did Latinos turn their noise into news?
I think the Latino community did a wonderful job of lifting up this issue and leveraging social media tools in order to amplify it, in order to make it an issue that went from just being a Latino issue to one that broke into the traditional space. And I'm really excited to see that. And I look forward to many more examples of this kind happening as we move forward.
Katie, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Katie Esquivel is digital strategist and vice president for Fenton. She joined us from the NPR studios in New York City. If you hear something in the media that confuses you or just doesn't sound right, tell us about it, and we'll look into whether it's news or noise. Hit us up on Facebook or Twitter. Coming up on Latino USA, women driven to skate in Mexico's roller derby teams.
She got her wrist hurt, and then I have an ankle, then we have surgeries. We still come here and play again. We're like, okay, my hand hurts, but I want to skate.
That's coming up. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Luis Antonio Perez from Vocalo, sitting in for Maria Hinojosa. For the past few years, the popularity of women's roller derby has surged in the United States. The trend is now catching on south of the border. In the Mexican state of Baja California, new teams exist in three cities, including Tijuana. The Tijuana team recently celebrated its first anniversary. Their motto, Mujer por Naturaleza, Roller Derby Girl por Elección. A woman by nature, roller derby girl by choice. Reporter Aaron Siegel tells us about the fierce feminine machismo of the sport in Tijuana.
Injuries, surgeries, bruises that blend from green to purple to deep dark brown. They're all part of the popular contact sport that's catching on here in Baja California.
You know, these girls have a lot of heart and they're so eager to learn and to train. So I've seen a lot of growth from them this first year.
Marcy Slayground, that's her derby handle. Her real name is Marcy Muriel, is a Mexican-American skater from San Diego. She's visiting Tijuana to help train the Mexican skaters. It's early at the Patines de Plata roller skating rink, and the venue isn't yet open to the public. For the next 3 hours, Marcy gives instructions. Some of the Mexican skaters are wobbly, while others expertly whip across the hardwood rink.
You have to teach everything from, you know, teaching people what gear they need to what skates it should use, and then the skating part comes into play.
The skaters hail from Tijuana, Mexicali, and Ensenada. After a series of stretches and warm-ups, they form a circle and introduce themselves one by one with their chosen derby names.
Madres, madre, número 8, Tijuana.
Psychochola, número 13, Tijuana.
Ana with balls, 29 de aquí de Tijuana.
At least 12 of Mexico's 31 states have roller derby teams. Dulce Desmadre started the Tijuana team over a year ago by recruiting players online. After a little more than a year, the Tijuana team now boasts 30 skaters. Reckless Alice became a roller derby girl last April. She says that when the team began, they bought their protective pads, helmets, and skates secondhand from local thrift stores. Now, most buy new equipment.
It's really easy for us to cross the border and go to the other side to buy the equipment we need. Almost all of us get our stuff from San Diego or online.
For many of the skaters, roller derby is as much a passion as a sport. Again, Reckless Alice.
I've always liked sports, but this sport is more, well, how can I explain it? You can't compare it to any other sport. It's almost like American football with roller skates. There's a lot of adrenaline, and between us, we're all very united, like a sisterhood. It's really cool to know these people like this. It's addictive.
Mexican roller derby is similar to American roller derby, with a few differences. Skaters wear the same gear and play with the same bravado and sass. Yet there are some technical differences. WFTA, the Women's Flat Track Roller Derby Association, based in the U.S., serves as a general governing body for many teams. Reckless Alice says the association is widely regarded as providing the standard in derby rules.
We are not certified with them, but respect them. I think right now throughout Mexico, all of Mexico plays by these rules.
Here in Mexico, like in the U.S., the derby girls are a colorful bunch. Many have piercings and tattoos. There's lots of fishnet tights, striped knee socks, and liquid eyeliner. Here in Tijuana, one skater wears a misfit shirt. Another has purple hair. A Derby Bitch sticker graces the front of one skater's black helmet. Derby girl attitude is a stark contrast to the stereotypical gender roles that still haunt Mexican women today. 2 years ago, the Mexican government distributed a guide to public workers called the Manual for the Non-Sexist Use of Language. It advised men not to say certain common phrases to their female colleagues, like, calladita te ves más bonita, you're prettier when you keep quiet. Dulce says women skaters are capable of doing the same as men.
As long as you say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do it good, I think we have a lot of will. She got her wrist hurt and then I have an ankle, then we have surgeries. We still come here and play again. We're like, okay, my hand hurts, but I want to skate.
At around noon, as the Patines de Plata rink opened its doors to a small weekend crowd, the training clinic wrapped up. Sweaty derby girls left in small bunches, headed for nearby taco shops and loncherias. For many on the team, skating is natural stress relief. The women say problems seem to evaporate during practice. The Tijuana team has big plans for the future, Dulce is now organizing a Baja California state team. It's meant to be made up of the very strongest skaters from the region. That would enable competition against more established Mexican teams, like Mexico City and Guadalajara. Tijuana is also taking advantage of their border location. Some upcoming matches involve American teams.
We're going to, you know, get strong, and when we get more stronger, we're going to go and play. On July, Monterrey is coming to visit us, and they're going to play versus San Diego and versus us.
But for now, the Tijuana Roller Derby girls are focused on improving their skills. Four times a week, they reunite at a basketball court in the park for practice. If it's rained, the girls have to take a broom to sweep pools of water off their makeshift skating rink.
We want to grow, and if we can help our sisters from Ensenada and Mexicali, we're going to do it.
For Latino USA, I'm Erin Siegel in Tijuana.
On today's show, we heard from and about many voices. Concerned voices from people in my hometown in Chicago. We heard the tough and determined voices of women in Tijuana. And we heard about the loud voices on social media. We heard our voices, community voices that have something to say about the world we live in. To me, the important takeaway here is make your voice heard. Because these days, anyone could be listening. And in the blink of an eye, everyone could be listening. So make your voice heard. And for this week, that's Latino USA. Maria Hinojosa will be back next week. Por favor, become our amigos. You can friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and we are now on Tumblr. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Lita Hartman, Andres Caballero, Daisy Rosario, Michael Simon Johnson, and Michael Jones. We had production help this week from WBEZ and NPR New York. Latino USA is produced by the Futuro Media Group in Harlem. The program was founded at the University of Texas in Austin. Maria Hinojosa is executive producer. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. News or Noise is funded by the Why News Matters initiative at the McCormick Foundation, fostering communities of educated, informed, and engaged citizens. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.